This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Pelka. Myanmar police arrested a famous actor wanted for supporting opposition to a February 1st coup. That's according to the actor's wife on Sunday. The arrest of Lu Min came hours after two people were killed when police and soldiers fired to disperse protests in Mandalay. The violence in Mandalay on Saturday was the bloodiest day in more than 2 weeks of demonstrations in cities and towns across Myanmar, demanding an end to military rule. Protesters are also demanding the release from detention of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi and others. The demonstrations and a civil disobedience campaign of strikes and disruptions show no sign of slowing down. Liu was one of six celebrities who the army said on Wednesday were wanted under an anti-incitement law for encouraging civil servants to join in the protests. The charges can carry a 2-year prison sentence. Seven election workers were killed during Niger's presidential vote Sunday. A local election official said their vehicle struck a landmine, marring a day meant to usher in the country's first democratic transition of power. The West African country regularly suffers attacks by Islamist militants and had stepped up security to protect the poll. The ruling party candidate, Mohamed Bazoum, is facing former President Mahamane Ousmane. The vice president of the Electoral Commission said a vehicle belonging to the organization and carrying the election workers to their polling stations hit a mine in the rural commune of Dargol in the southwest. We have more stories on voanews.com. Go there for the latest. This is VOA News. The head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog is meeting with Iranian officials in a bid to preserve his inspector's ability to monitor Tehran's atomic program. That's even as authorities said Sunday they plan to cut off inspector's surveillance cameras at those sites. Rafael Grossi's visit to Tehran comes as Iran tries to pressure Europe and the new Biden administration into returning to the 2015 nuclear deal that President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew America from in 2018. The British government has a new coronavirus vaccination goal to give every adult in the country a first dose of the vaccine by July 31st. That's a month earlier than its previous target. The government also has a goal of everyone over 50 or with an underlying health condition to get a shot by April 15th. Rather than the previous target of May 1st. Health Secretary Matt Hancock said on Sunday that the UK now has the supplies to speed up the vaccination campaign. More than 17.2 million people in Britain have been given the first two doses of the vaccine. Britain has had more than 120,000 coronavirus deaths, the highest toll in Europe. Italians are marking 1 year since their country experienced its first known COVID-19 death. With church services and wreath-laying ceremonies on Sunday, residents paid tribute to the dead, including in Italy's small northern towns that were so hard hit by the pandemic. Italy has seen 95,500 confirmed deaths from the virus. That's Europe's second highest pandemic toll. While the first wave of infections largely engulfed Lombardy and other northern Italian regions, a second surge starting in the fall of 2020 has raced through the country. In the northeastern town of Vaux, which registered Italy's first known coronavirus death on February 21, 2020, officials unveiled a memorial plaque on Sunday. Tanzania's president is finally acknowledging that his country has a coronavirus problem. This after he has claimed for months that the disease had been defeated by prayer. Populist President John Magufuli urged citizens of the East African country to take precautions and even wear face masks, but only locally made ones. Over the course of the pandemic, he has expressed wariness about foreign-made goods, including COVID-19 vaccines. The president's comments came days after the country of some 60 million people mourned the death of one of its highest profile politicians. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
What we try to do in all of it is to say, all right, fine. Yes, we recognize and we respect, you know, the steps that you're taking. But we are saying if your natives, your nationals, want to have the experience, Jamaica is the place to go, and we are ready for that.
The Jamaican government is working with the United States and Canada to help contain the coronavirus.
They have never provided masks to the population, to cite just these two examples. A health problem cannot be solved by security measures alone. Let him lift these measures, and better yet, let him resign.
A Gabonese civil society leader says the death of two peaceful protesters in the hands of state security officers is unacceptable.
Not to divide Zambians, but unite. Zambians now understand that competence is unquestionable, integrity is unquestionable. I have been victimized, we have been victimized, we have been arrested several times, taken to court, never convicted because we have not committed crime.
And the Zambian main opposition party, UPND, demands transparent and credible elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Jamaican government is working closely with both the United States and Canada to help contain the coronavirus. Tourism Minister Edmund Bartlett says his administration has also implemented new measures to protect travelers from the disease when they arrive. He admits that the global coronavirus pandemic has harmed the country's once booming tourism industry. Mr. Bartlett adds that he is working with international partners to develop comprehensive tourism protocols. The goal is to ensure the health and safety of visitors while preserving, in his words, the country's heart and soul. His remarks come after the government reopened the country's borders for international travelers, including visitors from the U.S. This following movement restrictions imposed by the administration to limit the spread of the coronavirus. Analysts say countries that heavily rely on tourism, including Jamaica, have been adversely impacted by the disease. They also predict their economies will shrink until an effective vaccine is developed that eases the safety concerns of travelers. To learn more about government efforts to resolve the impact of the disease on Jamaica, I reached Tourism Minister Edmund Bartlett in the capital, Kingston.
Well, it has had a devastating impact. It has literally reduced us from a level where we had 4.3 million visitors annually down to one point where it was actually zero. We have been building up slowly, but the levels of growth have been anemic, and the jobs we lost some 130,000 jobs in the process, and they're coming back, but slowly. The recent action by both Canada, you know, the US and the UK have had a really crippling effect on the recovery process, as we have seen a winter that is really a painful one for all of us. The economy has lost some 76 billion Jamaican dollars in terms of revenue flows into us for the year. So it has had a very, very devastating and deleterious effect on the economy and lives of our people.
Minister Bartlett, I'm sure you are aware that many countries are discouraging citizens from traveling abroad due to the pandemic. So what is your government doing, especially when you depend heavily on tourism, to attract people to come to Jamaica, particularly when a lot of people are concerned about getting infected?
Well, what we have done is to develop the capacity to manage the visitors who come to our destination, to ensure that the properties that they go to are all COVID compliant, and also to establish possible testing arrangements for them so we could know their state of health, and also possibilities for quarantining where necessary or isolation, and medical facilities that will enable them to at least recover before they go back to their destination. So we have taken these steps at the expense of the government to ensure that visitors who come to Jamaica are A, as COVID secure as is possible, but if something happens, there is medical and other logistical arrangements to take care of them.
Talk to me about Jamaica Cares, because last time we spoke, you spoke about it. How is it functioning now? And for people who come to Jamaica, you know, how will they feel or know?
Well, you know, in fairness, the explanation I gave a while ago is a big part of Jamaica Care, because what it does is to provide for you a confidence level, an assurance that this destination is mindful of the health scenarios that are prevalent, and that we have taken steps to ensure that you, as a visitor coming to our destination, will be as safe and secure as possible. We feel very strongly that the future of tourism, at least the immediate future, is going to be predicated heavily on health logistics and the ability of destinations to indicate a level of confidence in the travel public that they will be safe and secure once they are in your space. And that's what Jamaica has been doing. And that's what Jamaica Cares is about.
Minister Bartlett, is your government working with perhaps like the U.S. or Canadian government, since you have a lot of their travelers prior to the COVID coming to vacation in Jamaica, to work hand in hand about reducing any possible infection rate in the country?
Well, we've been working very closely. We pay a lot of attention to CDC and what CDC says. In fact, there's a CDC officer that is in Jamaica who we have regular and constant consultations with. You know, the Canadian partners are there. We work with the embassy and the High Commission. And we try to make sure that, A, we understand pretty much what is the prevailing conditions there and the steps that are being taken to manage their process, and for us also to comport as much as possible with those requirements. It is painful, I know, because, you know, some of our partners take very drastic steps, like closing their borders and literally shutting down on arrival. But what we try to do in all of it is to say, all right, fine, yes, we recognize and we respect, you know, the steps that you're taking. But we are saying, if your natives, your nationals, want to have the experience, Jamaica is the place to go. And we are ready for that.
Edmund Bartlett is the Jamaican Tourism Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Kingston. In Gabon, a civil society group is calling on the government to resign. This following the shooting deaths of two people by the police for protesting Thursday. They are accused of violating lockdown measures imposed by the government to contain the spread of the coronavirus. But Laurie Singdong, head of an organization called Let's Turn the Page, says it appears the administration is using the lockdown to curb any dissent. She argues that the rates of infection and death due to the coronavirus are so low they make the lockdown unjustifiable. Rather, she adds, the government should intensify efforts to educate the public about globally accepted practices that help curb the illness, including social distancing, mask wearing, and frequent hand washing. Supporters of the government say the imposition of the lockdown is the reason why the infection rate is low. They are urging citizens to follow the measures to protect themselves and their families. They also condemn as unpatriotic what they say is the opposition's use of the pandemic to drive down the administration's popularity. Civil society leader Laurie Singdong tells me that the shooting deaths of the two people are unacceptable.
The authorities in Gabon are using the COVID-19 pandemic to restrict freedoms. The COVID-19 test is required to travel within the country, to go to a restaurant, or even to enter a shop. A curfew has been instituted from 6 p.m. The number of places on transport has been reduced, and it takes much longer for people to get home. As the road network is poorly developed, huge traffic jams are created at the end of work. And those who are unlucky enough to be outside after 6 p.m. are violently assaulted by the forces of law and order. So a watchword has been launched inviting the population to make noise by banging on pots and pans every evening from 8 p.m. to 5 p.m. just 5 minutes. As part of this action, young people went out into the street with their pots and pans. They didn't break anything. They just made noise. The police arrived and opened fire. 2 young people were killed last night.
But Lawrence, the curfew, the government says, was imposed to ensure that people are protected from the coronavirus. That is why the lockdown was imposed, to stop the spread of the disease. Why are people just not respecting it? Why do you blame the government for imposing it?
Since the beginning of the pandemic, Gabon has recorded 75 deaths for a population of 2 million people. 13,000 people test positive and nearly 1,000 active cases. Do these statistics justify a curfew? At the same time, small shops and businesses have been closed without compensation. The 6 p.m. curfew is causing more problems for many businesses, which we have to close. Not forgetting those that have already closed since the introduction of these measures last year. In fact, the population feels more mistreated than protected by the measures taken by this government. To escape the curfew, people are piling up along the roads, desperately waiting for a means of transport to get home. Far from protecting the population, these measures increase the precariousness, the close conducive to the spread of the virus.
Opposition and civil society groups, including yours, are demanding an immediate investigation into the shooting death of these 2 young people. What has been the response of the government so far that you've heard about?
The spokesman for the ruling party made a statement today blaming the opposition for what happened last night. All protests are repressed in blood. There is never any investigation. The demonstrators are always guilty of having demonstrated. For this regime, demonstrating is a crime for which death is demanded and enforced. That is why it's more than urgent that the Gabonese people get rid of this regime.
But Lawrence, isn't the opposition behind these protests to undermine the government? Because supporters of the government are saying the imposition of the lockdown is to protect the people.
The opposition is not behind this action. No one knows who gave the order. The information spread through social networks and the population followed. This government is never responsible for anything. I would remind you that it is not just the curfew that is being contested, but the whole set of measures. And as I told you, in the light of the COVID-19 statistics in Gabon, these measures are not justified at all.
So, Lawrence, what do you think is the best way forward to contain the disease in Gabon?
What government must do is listen to the people, which it never does. The contested measures are not there to protect the people. In Gabon, the COVID-19 crisis amplified the failings of the regime. And it's not the 6 p.m. curfew or other restriction on freedoms that will change that. Drinking water is a scarce commodity. They have never provided masks to the population, to cite just these 2 examples. A health problem cannot be solved by security measures alone. Let him lift these measures, and better yet, let him resign.
Laurie Zingdong is the head of an organization called Let's Turn the Page in Gabon. She spoke with me from Paris, France. In Zambia, the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says it expects the Electoral Commission to hold transparent and credible elections. Zambians go to the polls on August 12 to choose a new president and parliament. But some opposition parties routinely criticize the Electoral Commission of being biased in favor of the ruling party, an accusation officials of the body deny. They say they engage opposition and civil society groups to address their concerns during the election process. Hakainde Hichilema is the presidential candidate for the UPND. He rejected the outcome of the previous election, citing voter irregularities and rigging. He tells me that his party will continue to work with the Electoral Commission to ensure the upcoming polls are credible.
The UPND has indeed engaged the electoral body not once, but several times. not only through letters, but through meetings, through discussions, discussions which include other stakeholders, the church, civil society, professional bodies, and other political parties, in ensuring that the Electoral Commission fulfills its mandate to deliver free and fair elections, to allow the people of Zambia to decide for themselves, to choose for themselves the leadership that they believe is competent, has good intentions, and will deliver for them and their children, including the unborn. Yes, we've engaged the Electoral Commission of Zambia.
Mr. Ishalama, in the UPND's engagement with the Electoral Commission of Zambia, what specific benchmarks do you want to see in order to accept the outcome of the elections in August?
Well, there are many minimums, but just to summarize a few. One, voters want to make sure that on the voting day, before the voting day, they will be able to see their names on the voter roster, voter register. No deliberate errors or omissions. Two, that on the voting day, voting will be peaceful. And three, that the counting, totaling, tallying, recording of result certificates, polling station result certificates, aggregation of results will be correct, will not be manipulated. Number four, that the true winner of the election will be announced.
Mr. Ishalama, in your earlier submission, you said Zambians want change. So what makes you think that you are the one they want to bring about the change they seek?
Zambians know that it's time for change. Zambians have suffered enough across societal spectrum, geography, across various categories of Zambians. Other than the small corrupt few, as I said earlier, most are hurting. When they see that there are no medicines in hospitals, they want change. Common people want change. How do we know that it's us in the UPND they want to deliver into government? They've said so. They are saying so at every opportunity when they can engage with us. And not just me, but all our members across the country, leaders across the country, and to other social or community leaders, church. The word change is on their lips, and they are saying the team that can bring change is the UPND team and its allies. We know it. Even those in the ruling party know it, but they pretend that they're not aware.
What makes Hakainde Hichilema uniquely qualified to lead Zambia in these times?
Well, we believe that we are uniquely placed to turn around the country, to improve the fortunes of the people of Zambia, to offer love to the people of Zambia, to offer God-fearing leadership, to offer servant leadership to the people of Zambia, because the people of Zambia understand that we have the vision, clear vision for that matter. We have the leadership capability, management included in there, and our ability to review for the better any challenges that come along the way. We have the experience. We've done it for ourselves in a small way. We are good taxpayers. Over years, we employ people. And they know that we are seeking leadership not to take from the people of Zambia, but to give. Not to exclude Zambians, but to include them. Not to divide Zambians, but to unite them. Zambians now understand that. Competence is unquestionable. Integrity is unquestionable. I have been victimized. We have been victimized. We have been arrested several times, taken to court, never convicted because we have not committed crime.
Hakainde Hichilema is the presidential candidate for the Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Critics of Cameroon's rehabilitation centers for former rebels are calling for a restructuring after some former rebels complain about the center's poor conditions. The former Anglophone rebels say the Centers for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration, or DDR, offer them little support and are failing to reach the goal of social integration. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
More than 150 ex-fighters are in a dispute over the disarmament, demobilization and reintegration DDR center in Bamenda, capital of Cameroon's English-speaking northwest region. Among them is a 27-year-old man who identifies himself as Dever, who says he is receiving training to be financially stable as soon as he is allowed to leave the center.
Here in the center, we have some trade that we are practicing, like agriculture, piggery, we have poultry, then we do sports, computer studies. We have even religious studies.
Zavres said he has been in the center for a year since he dropped his weapons and fled from a separatist camp in the English-speaking northwestern town of Ndop. Within the past 10 days, English-speaking former rebels at the DDR centers in Bamenda and the English-speaking southwestern town of Boya have been protesting. They say their living conditions are appalling. The former fighters say the government has failed in its promise to socially reintegrate them. The ex-fighters marched through the streets of Bamenda Monday. They also went to the office of Deben Chofa, governor of the Northwest region that includes Bamenda, to denounce what the former fighters say are poor living conditions at the DDR center. Sixtus Gapsia is director of the DDR center in Bamenda. He says he has forwarded the former rebels' grievances to the governor and the central government in Yaoundé. Gapsa says there are ongoing efforts to improve conditions at the center.
Hadaki is currently building a befitting DDR center very close to the airport on its surface area of 14 hectares. As I speak, two dormitories of over a capacity of 300 is already ready.
We have been able to reintegrate ex-fighters.
In the center, we provide enough security. We give them shelter, we give them 3 square meals a day, and we carry out training.
Monday's protest comes a week after ex-combatants at the DDR center in Boya staged a protest on the streets to denounce their poor living conditions. The ex-fighters said a delegation was sent from the capital, Yaoundé, with financial support for the center. Pan-Africanist and peace activist Mwalimu George Ngwane is executive director of the civil society organization Afrikafoni. He says Cameroon needs to restructure its DDR centers to stem the malaise among former rebels.
Understand that the ex-combatants are not coming to take up permanent residence at the centers. Some of them had skills before, they got into conflict. Access and take an inventory of their various skills and use these various skills to see how you can deploy them. So, for example, if you know some of them came in as tailors, as seamstresses, as carpenters, as mechanics, improved their skills that they lost while they were in the bush. Lastly, there are some that were in school. It's a way of how you can get them back into school.
Samson Websey is instructor of conflict management at the Yaoundé-based Higher Institute of Applied Technology and Management, ISTAC. He says the government finds itself in a tight situation if it has to give jobs to youths who have taken up weapons against the nation, while those who have been loyal to the state are either unemployed or underemployed.
If you treat those who first took up arms much better than the other youths who have been in civil life, those who have graduated from schools, they have not had jobs, those who have been searching for jobs without finding, you will find yourself in a tight situation. Because others will say, okay, for us to be given that kind of treatment, we also need to go and take up arms.
Websey said some separatists prefer fighting to dropping their weapons because of poor conditions at DDR centers. He said the government should invite conflict resolution experts to examine how to restructure DDR centers as an essential part of the ongoing peace process. Websey said the 30% unemployment rate in Cameroon is complicating the peace process for the government. President Paul Biya in December 2018 created a National Committee for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration of former Boko Haram fighters in the far north and former separatist fighters in northwest and southwest regions. Cameroon says it has about 400 ex-separatist fighters at the DDR centers in Boya and Bamenda. There are 260 former Boko Haram fighters at the DDR center in Mora on the northern border with Nigeria. On February 5, Cameroon said a recruitment drive for troops to fight separatists and terrorists had seen for the first time hundreds of former rebels stepped forward to join. The government said it would recruit some of those qualified ex-fighters, but it did not say how many of the 2,200 former fighters that would include. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
It's the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is urging government and the international community to come together to address worsening climate and pollution crisis to prevent future pandemics. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
After unveiling a UN report by the UN Environment Programme, UNEP, Guterres warned that the world faces a serious threat.
And the interlinked climate, biodiversity and pollution crises require urgent action from the whole of society. People's choices matter. For example, some two-thirds of global CO2 emissions are directly or indirectly linked to households. And this new report brings together the key insights of all the most important environmental assessments of recent years. And it uses those insights to chart a path towards a sustainable future.
The report, Making Peace with Nature, lays out the gravity of the three environmental crises: climate, biodiversity, and pollution, by drawing on global assessments, including those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and new findings on the emergence of zoonotic diseases such as COVID-19. The UN chief also welcomed US President Joe Biden's decision to rejoin the global conversation on climate change.
The fact that the United States is joining the Paris Agreement is in itself very important. A number of measures were already taken by the US administration in different aspects related to energy and other climate-related issues. It was also announced that the U.S. would restart their financial support to the developing world in regard to climate change.
The report, released ahead of next week's UN Environment Assembly, assesses the links between multiple environmental and development challenges. Amid a wave of investment to re-energize economies hit by COVID-19 pandemic, the report presents a strong case for why and how urgent action should be taken to protect and restore the planet and its climate. Inge Anderson is the executive director of UNEP.
We have to use this report as a guide to embark on a sustainable recovery from the pandemic, to make strong and meaningful commitments at the summits, to follow up with immediate action, because there are no backup plans for a planet in emergency, to redesign our economies and to ensure a just transition for all.
The authors point out that ending environmental decline in all its forms is essential to advancing many of the sustainable development goals, in particular poverty alleviation, food and water security, and good health for all. An example is how intensifying agriculture and fishing in sustainable ways, allied with changes in diets and lower food waste, can help end global hunger and poverty and improve nutrition and health while sparing more land and ocean for future. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's kick off with the African Champions League, where defending champions Al Ahly of Egypt continued their defense of their title with a 3-0 win over Sudan's Al Merrikh on Tuesday. Al Ahly are fresh from their third-place finish at the Club World Cup. They now travel to Tanzania, where they face Simba Sports Club on Tuesday. Simba also won their opening Group A match by beating AS Vita Club 1-0 in Kinshasa. Group winners and runners-up advance to the quarterfinals of the Champions League, which carries a $2.5 million first prize. Elsewhere, Nigeria's largest city, Lagos, will host a competitive men's senior football match for the first time in 20 years on March 30th. The Super Eagles will take on Lesotho in their final 2021 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier at the Teslim Balogun Stadium. According to the Nigerian Football Federation, the number of fans allowed in the stadium to watch the match will depend on the Confederation of Africa's football's COVID-19 protocols. The last competitive game Nigeria played in Lagos was a 1-0 Nations Cup qualifying win over Zambia in January 2001, while 10 years later there was a 2-1 friendly win over Sierra Leone at the Teslim Balogun venue. The Super Eagles have been playing their internationals around the country for almost 20 years since the cash-strapped Nigerian Football Federation decided to approach cities interested in hosting international games. Governors of hosting states have since had to provide financial support. Meanwhile, Ghana and Morocco played a goalless draw in their second group match at the Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations in Nouadhibou on Friday. On Saturday, Uganda beat the hosts Mauritania 2-1 in Nouakchott to finish second in the group and earn automatic qualification to the quarterfinals. Both teams were on 3 points and a similar goal difference before the match. Uganda, just like Mauritania, were playing their first ever Under-20 continental tournament. Still in Group A, Cameroon thrashed Mozambique 4-1 to finish top of the group. In Group B, Tunisia face the Central African Republic and Burkina Faso take on Namibia on Sunday. All four sides are still chasing a place in the final eight. With 4 points, a draw would be enough for Tunisia to go through. The Central African Republic, on the other hand, has no alternative but to win if they want to proceed to the quarterfinals. And in athletics, steeplechase world champion Beatrice Chepkoech broke the women's 5-kilometer road world record, finishing the Monaco run in 14 minutes, 43 seconds in Monaco last week. The 29-year-old Kenyan, who also holds the 3,000 meters steeplechase world record, took a second off the previous mark set by Sifan Hassan at the same event in 2019. Uganda's Joshua Cheptegei, the 10,000 meters world champion on the track, won the men's race in 13 minutes and 14 seconds. He set the men's 5-kilometer record of 12 minutes, 51 seconds in Monaco last year. The 5-kilometer was recognized as a world record event in November of 2017. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
What? rock sound in the building.
Everything that you do, Lord, I cannot tell.
That was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle and reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, from little dead seeds, great things are born. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.